All right, so here's a thought. What if the Federal Reserve just can't do what it is trying to do? From American Public Media, this is Market Plans. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday today, March the 9th. Good as always to have you along, everybody. All right, so here is the thing about this economy right now, or, you know, one thing, because it is a $20 trillion beast. As we've been covering this week through Chair Jay Powell's testimony on Capitol Hill, the Federal Reserve has been trying really hard to slow this economy down a bit. And yet, despite the central bank raising interest rates and talking the monetary policy talk, the labor market is still strong and inflation is still way far away from the 2% the Fed wants to see. And so one might fairly ask whether the Fed's tools just aren't getting the job done. And if that's the case, then what? We will ask those questions of Neil Irwin. He's the chief economic correspondent at Axios. Neil, it's good to have you back.
Thanks, Kai.
So what if I'm right? What? And it's not just me. There are other people saying this, including maybe a little bit you. What if monetary policy just isn't getting the job done now?
I mean, I think that's definitely what's happening. We have a 50-year low in the unemployment rate, 3.4%, at a time the Fed's been doing everything they can for the last year to tighten the money supply. It's clear there have been some shifts in the economy that just make their policies less effective than they used to be at adjusting how the economy works.
Lay that out for me. What are the changes?
Well, less employment and less activities tied up in physical, durable goods, right? So the things that you borrow money for, a car, a house, are a smaller share of the economy relative to things that are services, you know, going to restaurants, going to staying in hotels. So that might mean that interest rates are less effective. There's some other things in the structure of the financial system and how it works. You know, maybe businesses are lean inventories, they don't need as much credit, so raising rates doesn't affect how they behave. Wealth inequality might be a factor. You know, when so much wealth is held by mega billionaires, maybe it's a situation where their spending isn't as sensitive to what happens to asset prices as more middle class people. A lot of theories, but the end result is we definitely have an economy that's still roaring ahead, even as the Fed is trying to slow it.
Okay, so the Fed has raised rates 8 times in a year, give or take 4+ percentage points. Do you suppose it's possible that given all the changes in the economy, monetary policy just doesn't work anymore and Jay Powell and the gang need to find new ways to do things?
I mean, I think that's going too far. For one thing, there are always lags, and we may see these effects. There's some hints of happening already. We may see these effects really start to bite as 2023 progresses. And also, you have to think a little bit in counterfactuals, right? So what would have happened if they had kept rates at zero all of last year? We'd probably have an even hotter economy, even higher inflation. In all likelihood, their impact might not be what it used to be, but it's still in the same direction, meaning higher rates translates into lower inflation.
Can we talk about that lag for just one second? Of course, Milton Friedman, long and variable, 12 to 18 months or so. You point out in a different piece the other day, we're at 17 months now of this hiking cycle, give or take. And also, the Fed is communicating now like it never has before, and we're seeing effects a lot sooner.
That's right. So back in November 2021, as you say, 17 months ago, that's when they first started to signal, oh, we're behind the curve on inflation. We're going to start moving more aggressively. And as soon as they started communicating that, longer-term interest rates adjusted accordingly. And so that tightened the supply of credit in the economy. So, you know, there's a real good argument that those long and variable lags, as you say, the famous phrase, are not quite as long as they used to be. The problem, and Jay Powell emphasized this in his congressional testimony just this week, we really don't know. The uncertainty around those lags and how severe they are, it's really a wide band of uncertainty. So, you know, are we about to have a catch-up effect where the economy adjusts to these rate increases that were happening last summer? Maybe, but nobody's quite sure.
Maybe. That's great. One last thing, and then I'll let you go. You mentioned Chair Powell's testimony. I do want to touch on some of the pushback he has gotten from progressive members of Congress about the costs of this policy and what it might do to the labor market. You hear the phrase from progressives, you know, 2 million people are going to lose their jobs as the Fed keeps on raising rates. And Powell said at one point in a, not a testy, but a rather barbed exchange with Senator Warren from Massachusetts, she said 2 million people, doesn't that mean anything? And he said, would they be better off if we just walked away? So I guess the question is, what else is the Fed supposed to do but use the tool, blunt though it may be, that it has?
Yeah, I think the way Jay Powell and the Federal Reserve view the world is they don't want to cause unemployment. They don't want to put people out of work. But the history shows that the cost to doing the things they need to do to bring demand down, to bring supply and demand in line, to ultimately bring inflation down, a side effect of those policies traditionally, historically, has been to raise unemployment. And that's the real jam we're in. Now, could this time be different? Maybe, right? We're in a weird economy. The post-pandemic economy has defied all the expectations in a lot of ways. Maybe there is a pathway to have inflation come down without unemployment rising that much. But I think it's kind of a wait-and-see moment and see, you know, do we see progress on inflation even as we retain this robust job market we have right now?
Neil Irwin, chief economic correspondent at Axios, also writes the Axios Macro newsletter, to which you should hit that subscribe button. Neil, thanks a lot.
Thanks so much, Kai.
I don't know whether it was a little inflation agita or maybe some anticipatory angst about the February unemployment report that is coming out tomorrow morning, but all was not well at the corner of Wall Street and Broad and Lower Manhattan today. We will have the details when we do the numbers. We learned this week, yesterday technically, that the trade deficit grew in January, mostly because of imports of products and services from overseas. They outpaced what we sold abroad. And that in and of itself isn't all that surprising, given that American consumers rely on other countries for much of the stuff that we buy. Globalization is the word you're looking for there. But it is worth pointing out that even though we imported more than we exported, those exports were up as well. And point of fact, exports of consumer goods and vehicles hit records in January, and that's even after accounting for inflation. Marketplace's Justin Ho explains what's going on.
A rise in exports is a sign that consumer demand in other countries is strong. Katie Russ, an economics professor at UC Davis, says look at vehicle exports.
They're up in Asia compared to a year ago. They're up in Europe and South and Central America compared to a year ago. So this is really a global phenomenon.
Russ says other countries are recovering from the pandemic.
We've recently seen the European Union raise its growth forecast for 2023 in the Eurozone. The IMF raised its 2023 projection for Japan's growth this year.
An uptick in U.S. exports is a little surprising. For one, the strong dollar has been making U.S. exports more expensive overseas. Rachel Brewster, a professor at Duke, says U.S. trade policy has actually been discouraging many exports.
Unilaterally, we've imposed a lot of export restrictions on sensitive goods such as semiconductors. And the negotiations that we have been doing are largely with Japan and the Netherlands on reaching a multilateral agreement to shut off more trade with China on the export side rather than liberalizing.
Some of the increase in exports might not reflect growing economies. Christine McDaniel, senior research fellow at the Mercatus Center, says pharmaceutical exports were up by a lot in January. Thing is,
a lot of trade in the pharmaceutical sector is intra-industry trade, that is, large multinational corporations shipping to and from each other.
But McDaniel says there is underlying strength in the export sector. Other types of consumer goods are selling fairly well, too.
Cell phones, jewelry, stereo equipment, appliances, sports, apparel, etc.
Any increase in exports is welcome news for U.S. factories, says Chad Moutre with the National Association of Manufacturers.
We want a growing global economy, right? We want to be able to sell more of our products that helps lift overall incomes in the U.S.
And as the global economy keeps improving, he says U.S. exports could keep growing in the long term. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
As I mentioned, the February unemployment report comes out tomorrow morning. And at this point, the way things are going, your guess is as good as mine what the number is going to be. But if you're running a business, the labor market right now is headache number one. Confirmation comes to us today from Kalina Bruce. She runs the Noir Looks Candle Bar up in Seattle.
Our biggest challenge right now is just really kind of keeping up with demand. More often, we're having folks ask if we can come on site to do classes. And that kind of requires a lot because we want to offer the same sort of experience that someone might have when they come into our shop. It's not going to be exactly the same, of course, but we want to offer a similar experience. When we get like these weekday events, it can be challenging to try to find staff to cover the events because some of our staff are working other jobs. But yeah, we definitely need to continue to grow our staff as our sessions continue to be booked. I think that for myself as a business owner, it's always a challenge to figure out like what are the things that I can kind of outsource to take off of my plate, and then what are the things that like I need to be focused on. A lot of times when you're so like hyper focused on perfection, it can cause you to not necessarily utilize your team to the best of their ability, and it also causes a lack of trust. So right now we're at the point of really looking at folks who have been a part of our staff a little bit longer and trying to find ways to present them with leadership opportunities. We just celebrated our 1-year anniversary a couple of weeks ago, and we're continuing to learn and continuing to grow. The bigger picture is that we're utilizing our space as an incubator space to really like foster relationships and to support other small businesses and to support nonprofit organizations. So that's something I'm really proud of. And I hope that we can continue to sustain that. That's kind of like what keeps me going, is being able to use our platform to build community.
Colina Bruce, the Noir Looks Candle Bar, Seattle. Make of this what you will, but since the pandemic started, the percentage of customers seeking revenge on a company they feel has treated them badly has tripled. That's according to something called the National Customer Rage Survey. Revenge, by the way, being their word, not ours. In this digital and always-on economy, that revenge typically takes the form of public shaming on Yelp or elsewhere on social media. But the decision to actually leave that negative review or tag the corporate handle, turns out, as Marketplace's Matt Levin discovered, there is more that goes into it than just not getting what you paid for.
Andrew Keel wants to be clear. He is not that guy who regularly leaves bad Yelp reviews.
Somebody who has way too much time on their hands and insists on pointing out every irregularity and every issue.
But when a Charlotte area wing shop screwed up his nearly $200 order for a big Christmas gathering, and after he got no help from the manager, well, he was ready to let the world know.
There was that cathartic experience for about 2 to 3 minutes. Then there was the kind of like, am I going to come across as a male Karen, as a Chad? So then there was kind of the reviewer's remorse, for lack of a better term.
Even though a rising share of American consumers now look first to Facebook to whistleblow about lukewarm tacos or a bad internet connection, reviewer's remorse is pretty common. Nearly a quarter of customers with a serious gripe post their complaint on social media now, according to the National Customer Rage Survey. Scott Bretzman leads the survey.
There is a component here of not really feeling particularly great after you've made some sort of public pronouncement.
Bretzman says that while companies are more keenly attuned than ever to managing their online brand, only a third of customers who get a response feel satisfied. Sometimes that's because the response is corporate gobbledygook, but sometimes it's just because we're in a bad mood to begin with. Josh Maddie is an economist who has researched Yelp review behavior.
On Fridays, there are more positive Yelp reviews. But then on Mondays, it's the worst day for Yelp reviews. So people seem to be, you know, following the TGIF, thank God it's Friday, phenomenon.
And on Mondays when we have to go back to work? Well, let's just say Starbucks better not screw up my latte. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
Coming up.
You're very right. I did call it highway robbery.
Last year's supply chain was kind of like the Wild Wild West. But first, let's do the numbers. Yeah, the Wawa's again. Dow Industrial's down 543, 1.6%, 32,254. The NASDAQ down 237, 2%, 11,338. The S&P 500 sliced off 73 points, about 1.8%, 39.18. Banks tumbled ahead of that key jobs report I was talking about. J.P. Morgan Chase reversed 5.4%. Bank of America backed up 6.2%. In a cost-saving move, General Motors is offering buyouts to what it says is a majority of its white-collar employees. Shares down nearly 5%. General Electric, on the other hand, picked up 5.2% after confirming its 2023 guidance for revenue growth, earnings per share, and cash flow. That is quite something if you've been following the saga of maybe the original American conglomerate. When you announce you're going to wind down operations, your share price generally tanks. Such is the case for Silvergate Capital, which slid 42% today. The struggling crypto lender earlier posted a $1 billion net loss in its fourth quarter. Bond prices went up. The yield on the 10-year T-note thus fell 3.91%. You're listening to Marketplace. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. U.S. benchmark crude oil, West Texas Intermediate, about $75 a barrel today. The global benchmark Brent North Sea, about $81 a barrel. The Russian benchmark, its most exported grade of oil, known as Urals, right around $60 a barrel. A substantial discount or penalty, pick your term, as a result of Western sanctions on Moscow. Thing is, that $60 price point for Russian oil is right near a three-month high, and that has oil traders and oil policymakers alike wondering what's going on. Marketplace's Lily Jamali covers energy for us.
The war in Ukraine has scrambled the market for Russian oil, says research analyst Pavel Molchanov of Raymond James.
The pool of buyers immediately dried up after the start of the war.
And that was before two Western measures aimed at punishing Russia, an EU ban on Russian crude and a $60 price cap spearheaded by the U.S. There are big legal and logistical risks involved in buying Russia's Urals-grade oil. Molchanov says as long as the war goes on,
Urals crude will continue to be heavily discounted compared to just about everything else in the global oil market.
Since the war began, Russia has shifted some crude exports to Asia, with much of that discounted oil landing in India, Turkey, and China. Bill Smead, chairman of Smead Capital Management, says part of the recent surge in recent crude prices stems from China's emergence from pandemic lockdowns.
That had kept the demand for oil down for a while, but now it's picking up sharply.
And the pool of buyers in China appears to be growing, says David Fife, chief economist at Argus Media. Until recently, a noticeable share of a kind of Russian crude from Siberia was going to China's small independent processors in the so-called teapot refining sector.
They've been the main purchaser and in many ways the main beneficiary of cheaper Russian crude over the last 8 to 10 months.
Now, larger Chinese refiners are getting interested, driving prices higher, he says. But few things affect oil prices like a threat to slash supply, which Russia has promised to do.
For March, they have unilaterally decided to cut their crude oil production by 500,000 barrels a day.
The extent to which they'll follow through could have a big effect on where Russian oil prices go from here. I'm Lily Jamali for Marketplace.
We've spent a lot, and I mean a whole lot, of time on this program in late 2020, all through 2021, and well into 2022, talking about the container ship backlog at the ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach. Those days, thankfully, are behind us. We are at 15 weeks now with exactly zero backups, but that does not mean the supply chain has completely smoothed itself out. The legacy companies ships its stuff through L.A., kitchen equipment, appliances, and the like. Teresa Asbury is the president of the commercial division. We first talked to her about a year ago, and now we've gotten her back on the phone. It's good to have you back.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
So we have called you for a supply chain update, because last time we talked to you, I think you referred to shipping costs and your supply chain crises as highway robbery. And I wonder how things are going now.
Well, good news. I do remember the last time we talked. You're very right. I did call it highway robbery. So the good news is, at the time when we spoke, we were paying about $23,000 a container. That was at about the height of it. So now we're paying about $5,700 to the East Coast and about $3,600 to the West Coast. So significant, significant improvements. I sounded a bit like doom and gloom the last time we spoke, but certainly happier to not be sounding like that any longer.
I bet. But let me ask you an availability question. So you can do it for $3,500, you know, roundabout. But if you've got a load in Shanghai that needs to get to LA, can you get it on a container like now, or do you have to wait a week and a half?
More good news there. Right now, we're not really experiencing any delays. We're getting the containers that we need, and we're getting them at reasonable costs.
Okay, let's continue through the logistics chain. You get stuff on the container, it gets on a ship, it gets to the port of LA, where we know from other reporting that we've been doing that the backlog is gone, so you get it onto the wharf, and then what happens?
Then we can experience some delays. Uh-huh. There's some trucking delays. There's definitely rail delays. We've really transitioned our business, our inland business, away from rail.
Really?
We used to do quite a lot of rail a year ago, maybe a little bit longer ago. But it's become very inefficient, it's become very costly, and it's become fraught with delays. And it just made it much more preferable to ship via truck than via ship via rail.
Interesting. Interesting. Okay, next stop would be a warehouse. Talk to me about you know, holding your stuff until you actually get it to your customers.
Now, there we are seeing a little bit of difficulties or a little bit higher costs. So we have an example of this. We have a warehouse in Hamilton, New Jersey, which is a great place to have a warehouse. It's between Philadelphia and New York.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem is that a lot of other folks are looking at that area for warehousing. And with the excess inventory that ourselves, due to supply chain issues that we had previously, and others are experiencing, there's just not enough warehouse space to go across. So warehouse costs have gone up. Just, I'd say, in the last 2 years, probably about 25%.
So let's talk about two of those things you mentioned. Number one, excess inventory. How much of it do you have? And sorry, work with me on this one. The older inventory that you have, the stuff that came in when prices are high, that's more expensive to you, and you don't want to take a loss when you sell it, right?
It is, unfortunately. It is more expensive to us, but, you know, we're also in the position to move inventory and not sit on inventory.
Yeah.
So unfortunately, there does come a point where you do have to reduce your cost. You're probably not enjoying the margins you would like to. Well, you're certainly not, but you have to move inventory.
How long do you figure it takes you to work through your excess inventory, right? Because that figures into GDP and, you know, like all those.
Yeah. That really is the question, isn't it? We are expecting to be really out of most of it by the end of, say, the middle to the end of Q2. And when I say excess inventory, it is excess inventory, but it's not liquidation inventory. It's just that we have too much of it.
Sorry, one more timing question, then I'll let you go. How long do you figure, if at all, things are like back to normal for you?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I wish I had a crystal ball, right?
Don't we all?
I really do. I'd like to say that things are going to normalize in 2023. You know, we had a good 2022. The restaurant industry, which is a part of the industry that we play in, certainly not the entire industry, but certainly a big part of it, experienced a very good year in 2022. We had a lot of pent-up demand. So while we might not see that high double-digit growth for 2023, we do expect it to normalize to, you know, pre-COVID levels, which are pretty standard for our industry.
Right. Teresa Asbury, she's the president of the commercial division at the Legacy Companies. Teresa, thanks a lot for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Final note on the way out today, a quick last nod to the labor market. How about that? First-time claims for jobless benefits were up last week. 211,000 people made their way to the unemployment office for the first time, or website, I guess, now. That is the first time that first-time claims have been over 200,000 in 2 months. And I know you've heard me say we don't usually pay much attention to that number because it moves around a lot. It's a weekly number in a labor force of 165 million people. But jobs are everything right now. All right, we are going here, though, is your moment of economic context, maybe more like economic fun facts or something, though your definition of fun may vary. Depends. Anyway, I always thought it was interesting that the White House and the Fed get the jobs report early, the afternoon before, actually, which means that Jay Powell already knows. John Buckley, John Gordon, Rick Carr, Diantha Parker, Amanda Peacher, and Stephanie Seek are the Marketplace editing staff. Birbir Bawe is the managing editor. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdal. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.